unusable, I don't mean hard to use. I mean literally unusable. It simply didn't work, the first version. Here's how it was supposed to work. So the idea was right, and again, this was for cost. It was designed to be cheap. You know, good quality key switches, very expensive. Injection mold on the key tops, very expensive. Too much for what he was trying to do. So you had to have the PCB, and on the PCB was the traditional finger layout for bridging contacts. Sitting above that, you had a piece of plastic with holes punched through it, and then you had a conductive carbon-loaded rubber membrane. And sitting above that was a legend sheet, which had the key functions marked on them, and then a little metal plate at the top to keep it all together. And the idea was you put your finger through the hole in the metal plate, which pushed the piece of conductive rubber through the hole in the plastic and onto the fingers on the PCB. Two big problems with this. First of all, the PCB finger layout wasn't very good, so you had to push the key in just the right place to find where the traces were on the PCB underneath it. And secondly, the rubber was a bit stiff and not very conductive. So if you pushed it really, really hard in just the right place and you didn't get a key bounce, you might just about be able to manage to enter the keystroke. So for those of you who had, I know you had a ZX81, did anybody have a Spectrum here at any stage? No. No, well you'll be maybe familiar with the rubbery key, so that's where it all came from. So there we go. So a little bit more history, a little bit more personal now. That was the Mark 14 in general, and my website is called My Mark 14, and here is My Mark 14. A little bit hard to spot. This is my bedroom in about 1980, I think. So there's various bits of kit in here. So like there's a five-bit tape punch down there. So there's a bit of an early storage. And my computing section is up here. I've got two machines, got a NASCOM, I think that's a NASCOM 1 at that stage. And you can still see my Mark 14, which I've zoomed into here. You can see I'd expanded it. The first thing I did was build a keyboard. There was actually a I.O. connector on the edge of the PCB to plug an external keyboard, because Sinclair knew the keyboard didn't work. So at least he gave you some chance to get it up and running. And then I put it in a wooden box as well. But no way to remove the display from the PCB, so I had a little hole cut in the box. So if you peered at just the right angle, you could see the display. So I bought this back in 1978, and I added the extra RAM and I.O. So I had 640 bytes of RAM. Put a new keyboard on it, had a speaker driver, so you could take one of the output lines which came directly from the processor. It had about 3 bits of parallel I.O. wired into the chip, so you could make some square waves on that. So this was the first thing I ever constructed, and I plugged it in, and I got the monitor display came up, but when I pressed any key, nothing happened. Just the monitor display. What's going on? I had no idea. Fortunately, I don't know if you have Who Wants to Be a Millionaire over here. So I had a friend, and I phoned him. I said, I have a problem. What's going on? And the problem was quite simple. So I'd used my train controller, which was a 12-volt supply, which would feed the 5-volt regulator on this thing okay. But it wasn't smoothed. So every 20 milliseconds, the power would go off again. And Sinclair, being cheap, he put the space on the board for having a smoothing capacitor, but he hadn't actually supplied one with the kit, because that had been another few pence. So every 20 milliseconds, the power goes off, the monitor goes off, power comes back, the monitor starts again. So it got as far as putting the startup dashes on the display, and they would go off again. And my friend said, you need a capacitor. So I put one on, and then it worked. So, and this was actually very instructive. I think I've talked to a few people who've had these machines, who've contacted me through the website, and it seems to be a common theme that it's spurned a lot of careers in electronics and computing. Yeah, it taught you the basics of microprocessors and how they work, taught you to solder, taught you to program as well on a very low level, an assembler level. And this was all hand assembled. So you would write your program down mnemonics, you'd do the hand assembly, then you type it in byte by byte in the keyboard if you can manage to get it in, and then you could run your program. So this was home computing. We've come on a bit since then. Okay, so I guess everybody here is familiar with this curve. I've called it the technology value or worth curve, and it plots the worth of a system or some new acquisition against time. And this is typically the curve that something follows. So, you know, you buy it, it's new, shiny, exciting, the latest plasma screen, whatever it's going to be. And then it kind of settles down, and it's been in your house for a while, and it just sits there. And then technology moves on and you buy the next thing up and it turns into useless junk. My wife says, when are you going to get rid of this useless junk? But then if you keep it, maybe it starts to become a little bit collectible, and then if it carries on up the curve, it turns into a valuable classic. Now, I think the original Sinclair machines, in fact, a lot of vintage computers you'll see here today have followed this kind of curve. And so my Mark 14, after that, I had a Nascon 1, and then a Nascon 2, and then I had my first PC after that. And somewhere at the back of my cupboard was this Mark 14 thing gathering dust, and I moved house. And guess what time it was when I moved house? It was here. And I threw it out. So somewhere in a rubbish dump in England is my original home computer, if it's still there. And I didn't worry about that for a while. You know, life was busy and lots of stuff was happening. And then I started to get a little bit nostalgic. And then I got very nostalgic. And I decided I wanted my first computer back again. And what was I going to do about this? So, first obvious thing to do is go take a look at eBay. So you don't find many Mark 14s on eBay. Maybe once or twice a year you might find one come up. And when you do find one, I apologise for the quality of the projector here, they tend to go for quite a lot of money. Here's an auction that finished a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it was on eBay here in Germany. And you can see that the price finished up at 520 euros. And because these are very collectible and a lot of people started their career in these, people feel very strongly. There were two guys who had a bidding war for this, classic auction, and the last like 5 minutes it went from about 100 euros up to more than 500. And I could have bid for one of these, could have done, but there's a few problems with this. First of all, as I said, people, this is often their first experience of electronics, the very first time they've soldered them together. So they tend to be pretty badly made, and then they've been knocking around in people's cupboards or junk boxes for quite a few years, they get bashed around. So usually not in very good condition. And then if you did get one, obviously it's still the Sinclair machine, so it's got the original design problems, like a bad keyboard and not a fantastic display, and very hard to add extra memory to it. So all the memory decoding is done in TTL, hardwired directly. You want to change that, you need to start cutting tracks and bending pins and things like that. And for a classic, valuable, collectible machine like that, that wasn't something I wanted to do. So if I didn't buy one, what else could I do? Well, the obvious thing is go make one. So if I went and make one, I could make it to the quality that I liked. I could add more memory to it, as much memory as I wanted to add. I could have a keyboard that worked. Non-volatile storage, as I said, there was no backing storage standard with this thing, so you pulled the power out, the programs disappeared. So if I put stuff in SRAM and battery pack that, then I could keep my programs there without them to re-enter them every time. Maybe an option for a better display. And professionally, I work in software these days. I kind of moved away from hardware, and I miss hardware quite a lot. So it gave me a chance to play with hardware design. Might be cheaper, probably you can do it for less than 520 euros. And here's the important thing, it's hard to do. So lots of stuff to need to do, and I like doing hard things. I like a bit of a challenge. And I'm a bit crazy too. So I thought I'd go make one. Okay, so having decided I was going to make one, what did I want from my design? What was I trying to achieve? So this really shows you what I decided I was going to go for. So the original design had the SCAMP, actually the second version, the NMOS version, 5-hour only supply, clocked at 4.43 meg. And I wanted exactly the same CPU. So it means it had the same software, would run at the same speed, exactly the same way. Memory, so only 640 bytes of RAM. The monitor program, 512 bytes, and then the I/O chip. And so I want to keep all of those and have a compatible memory map, so I could run exactly the same software, exactly the same way. But also the ability to add more memory in a flexible fashion. We talked about the volatile storage, so I wanted to make the RAM non-volatile. And then, because it's so hard to enter programs into this thing, even if you have a keyboard that works, the original machine only had one memory map, obviously. So I thought I'd have multiple memory maps in the new one. So I could turn a switch and I could have memory map 1, memory map 2, memory map 3. So I could keep all the original software for the machine in RAM and just flick a switch and run it. And then one of the things I never did with my machine was to put Nibble BASIC on it or something like that. So I thought I'd have a large memory mode. Would have 32K of flash and 32K of RAM, so I could pretty much run anything I wanted to in that area. Keyboard upgrade, high quality keyboard. Small display. Well, having thought about the display, having the option for having a big readable display would be nice. But also part of the feel, the vintage appearance of the machine was the display. So I decided to hedge my bets and have a design that would cater for both an original display and an upgraded display. And then the glue logic that that decided all the memory mapping, the keyboard scanning, and the display driving was all done in TTL, in the original, as I said. So I thought I'd put this in some kind of a program device for the recreation, which means I could change the memory mapping if I wanted to, and I should get the part count down a little bit as well. Okay, so that's what I decided I was going to do. So how do I go about this now? What do I actually do to go and implement it? So starting with the parts, that was likely to be the area that was going to be the most difficult for me. So the two key devices I've decided to keep were the original processor and the original I.O. device. And these things have been out of production for 25 years or so. So where do you find semiconductors that have been out of production for 25 years? I didn't know. So I started in the obvious place. So I went and took a look on eBay. And as it happened, there was an auction came up for just the chips from a Mark 14. Not the board, not the display, just the chips. And I bid on those, and that was not very much sought after, like the original machine. So I went for a reasonable price. And then I thought, well, what if the chips don't work? What do I do then? Because I've no idea where these have come from, somebody's junk box for the last 20 years. So I had a look for brokers, and you may or may not know, there's a lot of obsolete semiconductor brokers out there. Mostly driven by the military, the space sectors, I think, but also for industrial equipment as well, that's still in production. So you can certainly find these parts, they're readily available off the shelf. These brokers expect to sell you a quantity of a few hundred for a new production run, and they expect to charge you commercial rates. So it's not cheap, and you may need to buy a few, but they are certainly available via that route. And I actually bought a tube of scamps and of the I.O. devices via this route as well, so I could be sure it's going to work. Display. So new LED display, these are plentiful, although it looks like these might be getting a little bit harder to find now. I don't know if anybody has any data on that. Since I did this redesign, maybe individual LEDs are getting harder to find. With the calculator displays, where could I find those from? So I got lucky. The guy who sold me the chipset for the Mark 14, we got talking after the transaction, and he said, oh, by the way, I've got a whole bunch of these calculator displays. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, I might be interested. So we haggled a bit, and I got a supply of those. Now, they're 12-digit rather than 9-digit on the original, but not a problem. Keyboard, so high-quality keys, no problem. I mean, Omron, I guess, are pretty famous for their key switches, which you'll find in all sorts of equipment. But how to go about the legend marking, how to do that? Well, that was a little bit harder. I wanted something that would be very durable, that would look professional and high quality, and that wouldn't wear off. So I have no idea. I do now. The way this is done is you do laser engraving. And I know about Germany, certainly in the UK, there's a number of companies that do this. And you give them your design files, typically an image file or something like that, or even a Word document that has what you want printed on the keys. And they have a machine that will use a high power laser to literally burn that pattern into the surface of a key. So I gave these guys my design for the keys, and that's the finished result. So I think you can agree that looks pretty good. Very durable, it's actually burnt into the surface, it's not painted on, it's not going to wear out. If you intend to do this for your machine, be aware that there's a bit of a failure rate. So these guys had about a 5% failure rate, so you'll need to budget for a few more key tops than you're actually going to finally need. And then for the memory, so I was trying to decide what to do with that, and in the end I decided I'd go for a 512K flash and a 512K SRAM, which would let me have plenty of those extra memory maps we were talking about. And what device technology should I use for that? Again, trying to keep the size of the board down, because the bigger the board, the more expensive it's going to be. And I looked at SOP chips. I'd never soldered surface mount before. And I thought, well, these things have a 1.27mm pitch. I reckon I could probably solder one of those by hand. So that's what I did. So what I haven't talked about yet is the glue logic. So as we saw, the original design was in TTL, so there's about 10 chips altogether that did the keyboard scan, the display driving, and also the memory map decoding as well. And for my new design, obviously I wanted to keep everything the original design had had, and then I wanted this idea of this banked memory, so I could have multiple memory maps and large memory maps. Well, that all had to go in. Not very complicated, you know, pretty straightforward piece of decoding. But the big issue was you needed a lot of pins on the device. So you're driving big memory devices, the top order address bits of those, you're doing the address decoding, you're driving a 12-digit display, you're scanning a 20-key keyboard. That all takes lots of pins, about 60-plus in the end. These are all 5-volt devices. So ideally you want some GUI logic that works at 5 volts. And this is going to be more and more of a problem, actually. As you guys will probably be aware, the move to lower voltages and lower power consumption probably started mid-1990s or so, and has carried on since then. So if you look at FPGAs, CPLDs, they're mostly only available in 3.3 volt I/O or lower. So if you use those, that means you have to have lots of level translators to bolt them into your circuit. There are still a few devices available. They're starting to go obsolete now. So that was one factor I had when I was looking for a device I could use. And the same problem with soldering. So if it was a quad flat pack or something, 150 pins with a quarter of a millimeter pitch, I couldn't solder one of those. I had to find something in a device I could solder. So I really came down to a choice of two. My first one was the Mac device from Lattice Semiconductor, originally AMD. And I'd designed with these before, so they were pretty easy to program in a programming language called ABOL. They came in a PLCC package, so easy to solder onto the board. But only a relatively small package. I think the biggest size they went up to was maybe a 48-pin PLCC. Not enough pins. So I looked at using two of these and ended up lots of layers on the PCB and lots of PCB area, not very neat either. So a colleague suggests I try an Altera 7000 Max device. And these come in 84-pin PLCC package with over 60 usable I/O pins. They also come with 5-volt I/O. So that solved that problem, and it solved that problem. So that's what I decided to use. But they weren't programmable in ABOL. They had a tool suite which was based on VHDL. So I've never programmed any VHDL before. I thought, how hard can this be? So actually, as it turns out, for address decoding, pretty straightforward. So a few days later, I had my code. Software tools. So Altera supply some free of charge software tools that will let you design with these things. There's a couple of issues around this device that you need to be aware of looking forward into the future, because I want to keep this thing running. First thing was the license lifetime. So although it was free, you still had to get a license to use the tools. And the license would typically last 3 months. So in 10 years' time, how am I going to change my design or modify it? Don't know. And maybe same issue for some of the other machines we have here. You think about products that require activation from Microsoft at the moment. So in 20 years' time, when I want to run up an XP system and there's no activation system server from Microsoft, how am I going to do that? Don't know. Actually, just recently, Altera changed their policies. They have a lifetime license now. So that problem should have gone away. One other issue with using FPGAs or CPLDs, though, in that their configuration is held in flash, effectively, inside the device. So how long is that program going to stay in place? How long will the charge down the gates? So they say 10 years, but we'll have to see. So I need to keep my programming tools available just in case for these things. And then memory map. I'm not going to go into huge detail on this, but again, this was a design choice. This is the original memory map for the Mark 14. You can see lots of repeats of the ROM and RAM images and the I/O chip and the display. And what I decided was going to do for each 4K image, and this is 4K in total, I would allocate 4K of flash and 4K of RAM, and I would just use the address decoding in the CPLD to choose which part of that would actually map into the physical chip selects. So it's a bit wasteful. So all this RAM, ROM I'm not using, all these RAM areas I'm not using, but RAM is cheap, and this is a tiny amount of memory. So that was quite straightforward to do. And then for big memory mode, so 32K of RAM and 32K minus the smidgen of the flash. Just enough space left for the display and keyboard and for the I/O chip. And on the board, here's how I choose which memory map I'm going to have. You've got a jumper which selects the big memory mode or the small memory mode, and it'll hex select, and just spin around to select the memory map that you want. Then creating the device. So I guess I'm not alone in having used Eagle in this room. Anybody else used Eagle? No? Nobody? Okay. So actually comes from German, something company called CadSoft. There's a free version available for cards up to Eurocard size. This was going to be a bit bigger than that, but fortunately I had a license for it that let me design the board. Tried hard to get it onto two layers, and it didn't go with the large memory devices. So I ended up with four layers in total, three signal layers and a ground plane. And then I had to find somebody to make it for me. I've been talking to a few people at the show, and they tell me PCB Pool here in Germany is quite a good manufacturer. I hadn't found those guys at those time, and I did a search on the internet to find what was going to be cheapest. And I found somebody in California, a place called PCB Fab Express. I think the same idea as PCB Pool, so not very fast, but they aggregate designs together and they farm it out to PCB fabs when they have spare capacity. So it ends up being quite cheap. I think I paid about $30 a board for this in the end, with a minimum order of five boards. And here's the board. How's it? Here's how it's shaped up. Designed the layout, I kept as similar as I could to the original machine, keyboard at the front, display here, the processor and the I.O. chip and the I.O. lines at the top. And I added a patch area as well, just in case I wanted to bolt some more hardware on at some stage. Board came back, got my components ready, as we talked about earlier on, and soldered it together, and switched it on. Very nearly worked first time. These are the finished results. You can see the two build variants here, one with the original calculated display, and then one with the larger HP displays in the place. If you look very carefully, I don't know if you can see this on the projector, there's just four resistors here. So the original design I did was with the Mac devices, and they have pull-up resistors built in on their input lines, which you can enable. The Alteras didn't, and so the four keyboard sense lines weren't being pulled anywhere. So when I switched this thing on, the keyboard went crazy, and I had to add the extra pull-up resistors, but that was the only thing that I had to do. Excuse me for a moment. So having finished the project, and then wrote a website about it with a few more resources about the early Sinclair machines, the Mark 14, and somebody got in touch with me and said, I'm going to be disposing of my Mark 14, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, I might be interested, possibly. So we haggled a bit, and actually had an unbuilt kit, which was mostly just a PCB, and then this thing. And I was talking earlier on about this was often people's first experience with soldering and putting kits together. And this thing had been his first project and been knocking around the back of his junk box for the last 20 years. So it was filthy and not very well constructed. You can see the resistors all over the place here. Some of the original components are missing, like the crystal didn't fit flush with the board. That tended to get knocked off, so he'd replace that with something completely different. All the chips soldered in, not very badly. Somebody pulled the voltage regulator off the back by the body of the voltage regulator. So it's a bit like restoring old cars, I think, this. So what I did was, I took one look at this and thought, okay, we're going to have to strip it down. So I stripped it right back down to the bare PCB. This was a later version of the keyboard, which almost works, which is stuck down, so that wasn't easy to remove, but everything else came off. Cleaned the board up, fitted sockets to all the right places, put new discretes in, cleaned and straightened all the ICs, put them in sockets, put a new voltage regulator on, and put some power on. And I had no idea if this guy had blown this thing up before he put it in his junk box. He hadn't, and it worked first time. So I'm really pleased to say that that was then an original up and running. So you can see all this at the show, so over in booth 5. So I've got the original that I just finished restoring. In fact, I only just did this in time for the show. Last Sunday, it looked like that. And last Sunday evening, it looked like that. So we just about got there in time. Got the reproduction Mark 14 here as well. Both of those are running, and you can see them in operation. I do have an intro kit that I acquired also via eBay. If you remember, this was the National Semiconductor kit that drove the development of the original Mark 14. I haven't put power on that yet, so I don't know if that's running or not. So it's a static display. Maybe next year will that be up and running. And talked a little bit about Chris Curry, who's part of Sinclair's team that made the Mark 14. Well, he didn't like working for Sinclair very much, wasn't very happy with his quality, and probably thought he could do something better by himself. So off he went to start Acorn, and this is the very first Acorn machine, Acorn System 1. You can see a lot of similarities, had a similar kind of keyboard, although this one worked, same kind of display, same I.O. devices, but this was based on 6502. And this led into the BBCB, and obviously eventually with Acorn into the ARM chip that we've probably all got in our pockets or our phones right now. And here's the last slide. So what am I going to do with this in the future? There's a few things left I'd like to do. It did have an optional VDU that came along later in its life, and I've got one of those, so I'd like to get that up and running. I'd like to get BASIC up and running in the device, and I have a listing and I'm ready to go with that when I get some time. It'd be good to have an Intel Hex Loader so I can assemble on a PC and then just download to the machine and get it up and running. And then the units that I've made, I'd like to leave them running and doing something. So I'm probably going to have a radio time signal decoder, MSF in the UK, I guess DCF77 here in Germany. And I'm just back from living in Japan for a few years, and Japan have a similar kind of thing called JGY, different format. So I need a decoder that, that would be good. And my kids love this. They can't believe this is a computer, and they each want one. So I'm going to have to make another production run to make some more. So that was it. That was the project. Any questions, comments, feedback?
The original board was two-layer only.
It was two-layer only, yes. Yeah, it was very very simple board, yeah, just TTL, and it was actually laid out by hand. You can certainly see that in places. It might be probably hard to see it here. You can see it on the original. This smoothing capacitor, the one I didn't have originally, doesn't sit straight on the board. It's a bit like that because one of the holes in the PCB is slightly in the wrong place. That'll be Sinclair for you again, I think.
There's another question. You said the original Blue Logic was about 10 TTLs.
Yes.
Did you try or consider using a PAL chip? That would be just about the right complexity for that.
Oh, absolutely. So I think, well, if I'd wanted to recreate the original machine with just the original memory map, I think that would have been a very good way forwards. Maybe the pin count would have been an issue again there, because you need lots of pins for that display and keyboard. But I decided I wanted these big memory chips so I can have the memory switching. So it would have taken quite a few PALs to do that, and so that's why I decided to go for the big Altera. Yeah, it's a question of design goals, I think, what you're trying to achieve. Yeah. And one of the other things I wanted to do with this was all the things I never managed to do, like putting BASIC in it and having bigger programs and so on. I wanted to have something I could have a play with and do that. And so that was one of the other reasons for driving that big memory choice. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming along, everybody. And if you get a chance, do please stop by and have a play. The one I have outside is a Mark V, the very very last Mark 14 that Sinclair released. And he did away with the rubber keyboard. He had some little metal dome switches, which almost work. So that was a big step forwards. Thank you very much.